Did you get okay without this?
No.
No.
Okay.
Did you click that?
I'm so welcome. I don't, you know, this is not going to be the most refreshing topic to talk about this early in the morning, but we've got to start somewhere. And so I think Bruce has set me up nicely to begin. And so I'm going to have you all by row. My topic is really to just sort of give a context about the disease of addiction and really sort of have you think about it so that when you're in your practice, you might have a more, I don't know if it would be like exacting thought process about it working with your patient, but you might actually have a more general knowledge base to think about it from different areas of psychology and medicine. And so what I'd like you to do is just play a little bit. So by row, what I want you to do is answer these three questions, just by row. So turn to each other, have a quick discussion about this. It should take just about 2 or 3 minutes, okay? So the first thing is, and given that that video was a nice introduction to this, what's the first word that comes to mind when you think of Mossberg? What's the first word that comes to mind when you think of addiction? And write down one common myth about addiction you believe is prominent in the population that you serve. Okay, so you can do that by row. So just meet each other, say hello, and then answer those three questions quickly by row. You've got to do a little teamwork here. So let's go around and just try to get what some of the rows came up with. So, and let's... believe it or not, I'm going to start backwards. So what are some of the common myths that you guys came up with when you thought about addiction? So what in this row, what was one of the myths that you think is sort of in the population? It won't affect me. I can keep going.
I think for me, in the table we're talking about is the myth is that there's a school cookie cutter approach to addiction, and that's the approach, you know, you just do it, and you know now that that cookie cutter can be completely shattered, and that individualized approach, there are hopeful new ways of dealing with addiction.
Everybody hear that? There's okay, I'll just repeat it. So the first group said, I can deal with it. Sorry, said it, or it won't affect me. As a myth, the next group said that, you know, it used to be that there was an old cookie cutter approach to it. I sort of, when you were saying that, I got the image of white knuckling it, right? You know, that I do this alone, I sort of just stop. And, or, you know, everyone goes to 12 step sort of thing. And now we know that there might be a variety of ways in which to treat addiction that might be more promising or equally promising.
It only affects the poor.
Only affects the poor. Wow. Never even thought about that. That's so that. Fifth by row.
We kind of did it in threes, but
that's fine.
That won't be on.
So there's some sort of character of the addict that means that they will definitely lie. Right, that they just won't be honest, and that, yeah, in treatment, in particular,
about their substance use.
There's usually that they don't want help.
People don't want help. Nothing will work, type attitude, and type in this. Okay? I'll give you guys a pass. We got it. People can't get better. Happen. Yeah, it's not my family anymore. Yeah.
We have several. You have to be a former addict to help others.
Oh yeah, that's very great. And that's a common myth among a lot of patients that you see, right? Yeah.
Let's see. Dependence and addiction are the same.
Do you want to hear that you have to be a former addict to help other addicts? And then dependence
and addiction are the same.
Are the same. That one you might need to explain to me. What do you think of?
medical dependence or the individual, once they take the medication, they go crazy. The addiction continues to happen.
Okay, did everybody hear that? You wanted others like you to just say that, because I don't think I can repeat that the way you're saying that. No, but I think you're making an interesting point, and one that needs to be made, and I just want to hear from that.
Dependence is an addiction, usually stems from a medical condition, and once the individual takes the medication, the craving stops because the pain is relieved. Whereas addiction, the cravings continue, whether the medication is taken.
Is that myth? Have you seen that myth? Okay, I think that is a little confusing to me, but I think I know how you're trying to describe that there's a psychological component to addiction as well as a physiological component. And while medication might work, there's some of the physiological parts, some of the cravings still might exist. Is that? Hi. Okay. They don't think they have a problem. But that's not so much a myth. That's just what you're saying a lot of patients believe, right? Yeah. They don't need help or don't want help. Okay, so let's switch gears. I'm going to start with you all and go towards addiction. What's the one word that comes to your mind when you think of an addiction? What did your road come up with? Helplessness. But that's how you think of, yeah. How about this road for addiction?
A cycle.
Just describe that a little more when you say a cycle.
Like, you know, you have a circle, and they just go round and round and round in a cycle. And if they don't, get help, like the most, you know, if they don't get that to stop that cycle, then it just keeps going.
So it's like it has its own momentum in a way or something. Yeah.
Right.
So I was just talking down the table. It seems like we had a multitude of things. So I see a denial. I see a treatment. Disease.
Meth.
They say meth.
But can I give you one? I want to go back to the myth.
You can.
That elderly people don't have a problem.
It's
a novel word. It's a novel word. Prediction
as well.
Well, it's not one word, but a lack of freedom. To be yourself, to make choices fully on your own.
Everybody hear that lack of freedom to make choices on your own? And the image of sort of like being a slave to something that's out of your control, I think is what you were describing there. Method. Any words for addiction?
Controls me.
Somebody else said that.
Myth? That there's a lot of myths around addiction? Hope. It's nice. So, you know, I mean, and the point that I'm making here is that we all come to this field with very different mindsets. And even within a practice, a healthcare practice, that's probably true even within that healthcare system of health, whether it's a small one like a mental health agency or a hospital. And so at some point, it's really nice to sit around a table, even at lunch, and just talk about what do you think about addiction and get people's perspective. Because it was such, it's such a topic of sort of societal influence. Let's just get to the Mosberg. I don't want to skip that. I think that video sort of spoke to it, but what was your word for Mosberg when you think of it?
We all had different words.
Okay, well, let's just get those and then we'll turn on. So what
was it? It was very diverse.
Yeah, so what did you get?
I said Mosberg. We didn't really ever get together on that. I said motivation was one.
Motivation. Other words?
Screening was another one.
Yeah, I mean, what's really interesting, I'm going to guess, did you all do words for Mosberg too?
Just screening. Yes, I don't know.
Health, screening. My guess is what you're seeing is that when you think about it versus addiction, the word addiction, or even these myths, what you're seeing is that with Mosberg, it's almost like a protocol that the state of Missouri has, in essence, sort of learned in what this protocol stands for with this catchy acronym. That makes sense? And that's really nice because it's taking the science of what we know. I thought, did anybody here use the word? Who was here in the first training I did, you know, like 5 years ago when I did Simler's Art? So when you thought of addiction, I thought, what did you have? What word did you think of with addiction? Did you have one?
Common.
Common? Yeah, nice. Okay, so when I think of addiction, I don't know about Dan or Bruce or other people who sort of study this. I always think of sort of the biopsychosocial aspects of the disease. I think of the disease as coming from lots of influences in someone's life, but it's really a combination of those things. It's a complex disorder. That makes sense? And therefore, it takes a it's not a simple, like someone said here, it's not a simple treatment regimen. It's a complex disorder. And we know today that part of it is genetic. That's clear that there's some genetic vulnerability, and we know it's either moderate or strong in terms of when they look at diseases, when they look at psychosocial diseases, or even medical diseases. In this case, when they do twin studies, they can tell that, you know, a piece of it is definitely genetic. And by the way, that genetic loading switches depending on the drug or alcohol, depending on the substance, I should say, the extent of the genetic loading. And then you think, well, what does that mean that it's genetic? You know, I started thinking, what does that really mean? That just means it's part of us, but what's literally transferred from one generation to the next? And then you start thinking, well, how does an addiction work? And you know, it has something to do with the reward system, right? And so we'll get into that, but you start thinking, so what's transferred? Is it transferred that there's a different expression of the reward system? Or a different need to have a certain level of dopamine? Or is there a certain enzyme deficiency, like GABA? So we're starting to uncover some of the genetic process, right? But the cultural and the psychological process are really fascinating. I mean, it's a very fascinating science. So for you all to be in that field, this field, it changes all the time. We learn more all the time. And I'm here just to sort of give you some context. So I think the question we're really going to be sort of examining is what makes people vulnerable to addictions and probably co-occurring disorders. We know now that it's pretty hard in our field, and even in Dan's list of possible associated harms that a substance use has, psychiatric disorders was in the list. And we know now that our field is sort of turning to be, it's now taking behavioral health and it's saying, let's really integrate that with physical health in the healthcare system, because the two really can't be separated. And that's probably often true for addiction as well. So, you know, we know that our views of addiction are very much socially influenced. And even how we feel about a quote-unquote addict is very much socially influenced from our culture, right? And whether we have hope or whether we judge that person as being a person who just can't control what they're doing and actually see them as having a character flaw, which I think a lot of people in our environment might do, just not even consciously they might do it. That, oh, come on, they could stop if they just wanted to. Was that your...
Like they people choose to be...
Yeah, people are choosing that. But, you know, I think pieces of all of these things are probably somewhat true. It's just to what extent are they true? You don't know that person's genetic loading pattern, right? You don't know the circumstance of their co-occurring disorders. Have they had a trauma? You know what I mean? So before you think of someone as can't control it. So what we do know is that when you compare addiction diagnoses, the heritability, the roots of it, the response to treatment, it really becomes more like other chronic medical diseases. And that's why this idea that it's biopsychosocial, that it really... Probably the most respectful way to look at it is someone has some kind of a medical disease that has different components, some psychological, some medical, but that why we don't really judge a person with diabetes, you know what I mean, so much, right? I mean, there might be certain symptoms of that, and there might be certain behaviors the person does, but do you judge someone with cancer? Do you think they have a character flaw?
You know what I mean? And what's interesting is Bill Miller early on, so many people, and he's such a person who's sort of struck out against the word denial and this myth, that he did it. They went and looked for, I think it was Marlatt and Miller did some follow-ups. But they looked, was there some character pattern? Was there some kind of characterological default in people with addiction, particularly alcoholism at the time? And they never could find any one sort of personality type. Does that make sense? So they never found this energy of denial that was associated. Is it true that people who have addictions lie? Maybe lie a greater proportion to people who don't, particularly to keep their addiction secret? Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the behavioral symptoms of an addiction, and it becomes like a habit. Lying like an addiction becomes a habit. So if you're a treatment person, you go, okay, well, we can help you treat the lying that comes with that, right? And so they would have to sort of figure out why they're lying. You would do a behavioral intervention for it. So we do know that for some folks, it's clear that brief motivational interventions can have a positive effect. And we also know that for others, long-term care strategies can actually have benefit. What else do we know about addiction? We do know that it's clearly a large influence of the brain comes from this center that people call the reward center. And we know much of that has to do with dopamine. And so, you know, when we think about one of the very effective treatment responses to addiction, we often think about contingency management and rewarding activities. How do you substitute healthy rewarding activities for the use of alcohol or some substance that also gives you dopamine, right? So the idea is if you can find other parts of your life that become rewarding, that can be very successful. You can, so the other thing is if you can, in essence, reward people to stay clean and to get to treatment. And so there's this whole incentive-based or contingency management approach that can be very effective, particularly with youth, right, and adults to attend. This arrow is just showing that where brain development occurs, and that's why most youth that come into treatment come in at about 15 and a half years of age is when they're first sort of picked up. It might start at 11, 12, the age of onset, so their first initial use might be younger, but where we tend to see them in the treatment system is about 15 and a half, and what this is showing is that development sort of limits how much judgment we have early on, and there might be lots of evolutionary reasons for that, because you want creativity in your youth, and you want them to do things to sort of change society or to change the way we sort of evolve. And therefore, when you look at the developmental pattern, we get this reward system, we get coordination, we get social facilitation much earlier as humans than we get this idea of judgment, the frontal lobe. And what we know about addictions is they tend to sort of block in some ways the neural pathway of those judgment responses, right? And they've done some neurobiological studies about that. Are people with full-blown addictions, are they less able to elicit judgment responses, in essence, and are they more focused on the reward system? Okay, and Bruce and I were just talking about this, and this is a continuum slide. This basically says when you think of an addiction, you can think of someone going through different parts of being addicted to a substance and their mood being affected with greater intensity, in essence. So it's sort of like on a continuum, right? And now what Bruce was just saying is that in the DSM-5, it really looks at abuse. It no longer sort of looks at categorically abuse and dependence. It says it's much more on a continuum, a disorder, and that everyone has substance abuse, but how many symptoms of that abuse, I guess, are involved. And I would just, if I were all of you, I would just question, just like myself, now I'm going to go back and really study the DSM-5 to see if it really changed the thinking. I think if you're in this field, you always thought that people weren't just, either they weren't just abusing or dependent. In fact, you often thought that it would swing with what was available. You know, how much money was available or how much of different drugs were available. Many people are very opportunistic in their use patterns, period. That when there's a lot of weed around, they smoke a lot of weed. When there's a lot of coke around, they do a lot of coke because, and typically they might not even just have one type of substance they're using, but several. In this language, what I really liked about Jelinek's language from the 50s, and he really did it for alcohol, is that he's the one who really sort of coined it a medical disorder in the terminology, but what he thought is that people learn this mood swing, and when you see youth in particular, how many people here, just raise your hands, treat adolescents or young college students or college students, right? Yeah, I mean, what I typically see when you talk to them, what you see is often there's agitation there that these youth will tell you, if you really talk to them, that they're not comfortable in their own body, that either they feel hyper, sort of like they've got to get out of it, or they feel on edge because of anxiety or trauma. And so there was some non-homogeneous balance in their body, literally chemical imbalance, whether it started when they were very young. And if you talk to elementary school teachers, they'll tell you that they knew that that youth was going to end up using substances early on because they could see how they acted in the classroom. They weren't able to sit still. They couldn't have a calming response.
Studies on untreated ADHD.
Yeah.
More prevalent.
Willens, Timothy Willens from Harvard has done studies on that and showed if you treat ADHD early, you can take away some of the risk of substance use. And so what you see is generally youth with a profile of not being comfortable in their own body or not learning how to soothe themselves. That's another word for it. And therefore, they find a way of coping with their mood. Does that make sense? It's actually quite a good strategy, really. It's just that it happens to be illicit, and it happens to probably cause more harm. So in the short run, this is what we often say about people's responses to anxieties that end up in the long run being bad for them. But in the short run, their strategies aren't so bad, right? They're pretty successful if you find something to cope with your mood. So psychologically, it's not like a bad response. It's just that the long-term effect is bad. So I'm going to skip these criteria. What I will go to is just, I really think there is some key psychological studies, social psychology studies, that you all should just be aware of if you're in the field of addiction treatment. And these studies, basically, they come down to a couple of words for you. One, human beings are really strange, all of us. It's not just like one of us or two. It's not like that addict is strange. We're all strange because we all have this human psychology. When you really look at human behaviors, they're a bit strange. First of all, the one really strange part is that situational factors influence us much more than we believe they will. Does that make sense? That we assign ourselves to have this great independence choice, right? That we are all free spirits, essentially, and that we have the ability to make up our own mind. And that's a good thing, because that gives us a sense, sort of self-efficacy, a sense of power. So you don't want to take that away. But the issue really is that people in situations act much more like sheep. They act much more than these cues, like animals. We do. We act much more like other animals because of our psychology. So these experiments, Zimbardo's, Milgram's adds a little piece to it, but Zimbardo's prison study essentially says to you, look, you can be put in a role, and even if you never thought you would act like that, start like to act like that. Because so he gave some people were prisoners and some people were police. They basically were neighbors in Palo Alto, California. But he created a fake jail cell. And my only point here is that, and if you think about it, is everyone who says, hey, no problem, I can go to the party and not party, you should just explain to them the prison study. You know what I mean? Could you be in a prison and not act like a policeman or a prisoner? Right? And the reality is people can't. Right? The other part that Milton, I would go more into, but I want to go a little quicker. And it's fascinating. You can just look it up on Google. It was a fascinating experiment. What Milgram did is he really was following up on World War II and people saying, you know, that the Germans at that time were like not human. And they did do atrocious things that weren't really, quote unquote, human, that lacked empathy and it was horrible. But besides that, when you look at the psychology of it, he basically said, given an authority figure, human beings, even Americans from the streets of New Haven, Connecticut, will do atrocious behaviors, even in like a lab at a university, and he proved it. He basically showed that he told people they were doing a memory study. You should look it up. And it wasn't a memory study. It was a study on whether people would do atrocious things. He basically lied to them, and it's harder to get away with that kind of research today. But you can do it, you still can sneak people into doing things. And what he showed is that given the right authority figure, and
different personalities. Many of them actually delivered shocks to people that they thought would actually give somebody a heart attack by just being told they got that memory question wrong, you need to shock them, it's going to help their memory. And so the person would shock them, and in essence they'd be screaming, and the authority figure, no, 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 that's part of what you need to do here. I'm telling you, this is going to work. And they did it. They, even though they knew they shouldn't have done it, so they were literally having like little mini nervous breakdowns, trying to decide, right? But they still followed through. And the point here is that if in a group of people, if there's a leader, right, our tendency is to sort of follow the leader. So again, you go to a party and your best buddy's drinking, or he's like, yeah, sure, you can handle one. Well, you know, you'll probably follow and try to handle one. Or if he says, come on, let's do it. So peer pressure is sort of a real psychological enemy. Does that make sense? And we also know that our advertising industry capitalizes on that fact. The advertising of alcohol and drugs, or cigarettes, or, you know, we call it three basic nicotine, right? The advertising of that fact is a huge industry. There's billions of dollars are spent capitalizing on these elements of human psychology. Do you realize that? So they literally take like the coolest guy in the group and they have that guy drink, so everybody wants to drink with that person, or the coolest woman in the group, so they use that. So what Ash did too, which is very strange, is Ash basically, at my school, he basically said, look, I can even convince people that they're seeing what they're not seeing based on social conforming. So basically this idea of peer pressure, and also in some ways, you can tell yourself that a certain reality exists and you can make it exist. So people might tell themselves it's not going to hurt them, or they can continue to drink. And that's their reality. And he did it with lines on a board. Are you guys aware of that? That he put different sized lines on a board. And he paid people like we always do. We fool the other person in the psychology experiment. So he paid a group of you to say that those lines were similar in size. But you all just met in the waiting room, like you all just got there. But you guys are what we call confederates. And you come in to do the experiment and you think they're like you. And then they're looking at these lines and they're telling you they're the same size. And you're seeing them as different, but because they're saying they're the same size, you really start to believe they might be the same size. That makes sense? And that's called a social conformity. And so my point is, when you think of addiction, you have to bring with it the weight of these social psychology experiments and our social psychology, because it really goes into addiction. And the one that is really probably most prevalent, particularly in some initiation of alcohol and initiation of substances, is what we think it's going to do to us before we even start using it. That's called a positive expectancy. And we know from experiments with bar labs that people truly believe, even if they think they're drinking alcohol, that they are like better looking, sexier, can talk to women easier. Women, college students have been shown that even if they never got a drop of alcohol, but they were told they were drinking and they're in the bar lab, they really start to feel drunk. And it's basically a placebo effect, right? So you can tell yourself, and what happens is, and this is what you have to understand about our culture, is that when at a young age we see advertisements, and they show people having a great time on the beach drinking a six-pack of Miller, right? Here, this is our culture. Just listen, for when I come into this hotel, right? And they don't just give me two drink tickets, they give me four drink tickets. And they don't say to me, hey, you can have a healthy bar or granola bar instead. They just hand me these drink tickets and they say, go at it, man, you're here in Missouri, right? In Vermont, I get just like, Vermonters are too cheap. They won't give you a drink ticket. It's expensive. In Vermont, they might give you like an ice cream pot and a cherry. But here, I'm telling you, our culture is a culture of use. So when you combine the use culture with the human psychology, it is really hard if you're having addiction. You get that to get over. Because all of this goes into it, right? Before I even took my first sip of alcohol, like any of us, we've already seen millions of images about how fun alcohol is. So why wouldn't I want to try something that looks so fun? Right? And it continues. It's not like those have stopped. They haven't decreased. And in fact, I'll just, another little, an inside joke of the advertising industry is when they realize that new initiatives of drinking were young females. What they did is they made these alcoholic beverages that were like mock beverages. So they did these sweet teas and all these. They weren't really supposed to taste like alcohol. They were like sweetened alcohol. You know what I'm talking about? All these like lemonades and stuff. And so they literally targeted a whole market because they knew that people weren't sort of drinking beer in a certain age category, and they wanted to capture that age category. So this stuff is really important, and when we think of addiction, we often don't think of this. That makes sense? But this is in the background all the time. Okay. I think I'm going the right way now. All right. So this is just a slide of some prevalence rates to show you that generally, when patients come in to see you, no matter at what age, if you were to really look at their history, a large number of them as youth from the ages of 5, maybe to 15, might have had some early discomfort, some early mental health discomfort of some type. It might be an internalizing disorder or an externalizing disorder. Do you know what those are? When you think of internalizing disorders, you think of anxiety, you think of trauma, you think of depression. Does that make sense? When you think of externalizing disorders, you think of disruptive behaviors. And it could have been both or one of those. But typically, it's not all youth. I mean, it's not like it's all youth. But if you were to go to youth in the legal system, it might have been 80% of those or 70% of those have this type of early distemperament. If you look at typical patterns of people come in for addiction treatment, the numbers range. But certainly, definitely, 25% upward to 50% will have had some kind of primary. Because they always say, what came first, the chicken or the egg? And pretty much in co-occurring disorders, we can sort of isolate now that, yes, it's very likely that the youth had some kind of mental health, you know, distemperament or something going on in a large majority of those people. Right? So if you think of it that way. All right. It does mean also that once people use, they also start to get anxiety too. So there is some that come after. I just put this slide here. If anybody wants these slides, I'm pretty sure, Matthew, you're going to put them up on the
Eastburn and Moseburg website.
Okay, there you go. So don't worry about copying anything down. Just enjoy it. If you can enjoy it. But I mean, if you look, if you look, let me just say this. Look, what we didn't know, I mean, when I got in the field, there were literally 14 published studies on adolescent treatment, and there was very few long-term outcome studies on adolescent treatment. That's when I got out of graduate school in 96, 97, actually, really, like, I finished in 98, right? But if you look, there was very few. So you guys are on this renaissance of addiction studies. I mean, we've literally put a lot of energy in with Moseburg. You guys have put a lot of energy now into ESPERT studies. So we're even learning more about brief interventions and what it can do. We didn't know anything about victimization in youth and the rates. And when you really ask youth who are in treatment, and even when you ask adults, how often have you feared for your life, or have you ever feared for your life based on some kind of abuse or neglect or sexual assault? Many of them in the last 90 days will say yes, and many of them in their lifetime will say yes. And so it behooves you, if you're in this field, to learn something about trauma care. If that makes sense, at least learn how to make a good referral to a trauma specialist, and particularly with the wars now and the vets coming back from war. So I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about it. So the bottom half of that table, when you look at it, is all about victimization. And there they're using the GAIN. Have any of you heard of this GAIN assessment tool? Global appraisal. So there's a very specific question about it. We just weren't asking about it. So there's some population trends in here, just to give you an idea of. When I first did this, I looked at 2006. For this, I looked at 2010 for some of the slides. And marijuana, which is marijuana was the most commonly used illicit drug in 2010, and it actually overtook, I think, new initiates in this later part, 2009, 2010. In the country, and I wonder if that's some of the legalization and the lack of perception of risk now with marijuana. If you talk to people in Colorado, if you talk to people in Washington, and I don't know where Missouri sits with this, but Vermont is also heading this way, that they're sort of decriminalizing, they're sort of making marijuana seem like it's not a big deal, really, in our culture, again, in terms of the influence for many kids. They'll say, well, come on, it's legal, like in half the states, how come you even care about this? And, I mean, we do care, because at a young age, it actually can cause a lot of harm, right? So, but that's something to watch out for. It looks like more people are starting to accept marijuana.
between 2010 and 2010, the rate of use increased from 5.8 to 6.9%, and the number of users increased. So it's not like we're effectively on a downslope with marijuana. It seems like we're on a little bit of an upslope with marijuana use. At one time, we were on a downslope. I don't know why that's... Am I doing something? Should I be going this way? It seems like when I go this way, it goes...
Yep, you're going the right way.
Okay, so psychiatric disorders coexist in about 20% or 30% of persons with substance use overall. The most prevalent ones are depression, anxiety, PTSD, social phobia, and bipolar disorder for adults. That's a little different with adolescents. What we do know is that if people have co-occurring disorders, the outcome rate and the effectiveness that you can have if you just treat the addiction is lower. Does that make sense? Because even if you successfully get somebody to go into recovery, they're still experiencing those symptoms that the addiction was helping them with. So it complicates the picture. So we know the best way to work with a co-occurring disorder, and often it's multiply occurring, is to do it integrated. To at least try to work with both, ask about how the symptoms affect each other. How does your... Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Yeah. I've heard varying responses and varying research out there saying if somebody has trauma or they have a psychiatric disorder and they also have an addiction, which do you treat first?
Yeah.
It seems like you kind of go back and forth. And I just wondered if someone wanted to share some insight on that.
Concurrent.
Same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's clever. It's hard. It's hard. It's absolutely hard. And I would say, you know, the motivation is in all of us would probably say treat the one they're more, most willing to work on, but really you need to treat both.
Right.
So it's, I mean, when you look at the principles of treatment, it's really integrated. Right. And in fact, the folks who have sponsored Mosberg and the folks, you know, Sanchez is coming out with an integrated treatment model that people will get free. You know, there's an integrated change therapy, it's called. So really, you look at it as integrated. Yeah.
For me, my understanding is that when it, say you're treating like an opiate addiction, and it's common that there's a connection with trauma there, and that you would want them to get some clean time and stabilize and sustaining some skills before that you would want to really get in and begin to work on the trauma itself. Because if you're doing that at the same time, the substance abuse and working on the trauma, it sort of runs into conflict with each other because the person is going to have reasons want to use
if
trauma brought up.
Teaching skills is integrated.
Sure. That makes sense. I think that's the appropriate response. That in essence, you have a treatment plan that's integrated. And what you're saying is that you've talked about it with your patient. And, you know, if they were to say, look, I really want to talk about this part of the trauma right now, you're not going to say, well, wait, it's not in your treatment plan. You're going to go with what they say. But you have a strategy that's going to say, we want to give you some skills so you can actually deal more effectively with what comes up around the trauma symptoms. So you are, in essence, working in the way that, you know, we would expect people to want to work. Right? But the patient might lead you there, too. You know, they'll tell you. And when you do so, 10 minutes, okay, I got that trouble. So when you do this kind of treatment, I just want to say you want to do what's called a situational awareness and really help any patient become aware of their triggers for both their symptoms of their trauma and their symptoms of their addiction. So that's like step one. And in a way, that's an integrated step, right? You're saying, how do they influence each other? But right now, I just want you to have some self-awareness and tell me what happens when you enter certain environments and try to learn what happens for you. That makes sense. So self-awareness monitoring, you might call it, is one of the first steps. And it doesn't have to get into exposure of the trauma.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. Yeah, and in fact, some people don't even do exposure. There's equally efficacious, there's cognitive restructuring, like I'm just talking about, can be as effective as exposure treatment for trauma. So we could discuss what's even more effective. So look, there's a lot of use. I don't need to go into these stats. I find them, I mean, I think that last time I presented them, I did them in 2006. But, you know, I was trying to say that in terms of now that you know those social psychology studies, a lot of us drink alcohol.
It's very, very prevalent. It's what we do as human beings. It's how we celebrate. And, you know, I mean, I'm guilty. Even when people don't want to drink in my house, when we're having dinner, and I didn't know they didn't want to drink, I still offer them a beer. And they'll say, well, I didn't drink last time. Why would you offer me a beer this time? And because I see it as part of being gracious. If everybody else is having a beer, why don't I offer them a beer? And so, but I didn't know, you know, they didn't say, well, no, recovery, don't offer me. I didn't do that, right? But the reality is that, you know, we just drink in our society. That's just what we do. It's rare not to. We do it in this hotel. In fact, they want, I mean, that's what I'm saying, they want you. So, if you, right, if, what's that? I mean, you know, that's the reality of our society. So it's not like, if you're going to get any disease, why wouldn't you get a disease of alcoholism where it's sort of accepted that that's what everybody does? Right? The problem is that we can't all stop. That's the problem. It's not that we can't drink. That, the problem is not drinking. It's that we can't stop drinking. Right? This age is an important factor. It's very rare. You know, what you start to see in the curves is that a lot of this disorder takes place between the ages of 18 and sort of 30. It's not that old people, that myth out there that you said, old people aren't alcoholics or something like that, or, you know, they can handle their liquor or something. It's not that. It's just that most of the people with the most trouble from addictions is in the ages of 18 to 30. That's sort of the most common place for it to really come out. Does that make sense? And that's really the real, where the culture of use is even stronger. Look at any college campus or any group of kids partying, right? This is very important for you to know just as a screener. Persons reporting first use of alcohol before the age of 15 were more than 5 times as likely to report past year alcohol dependence or abuse than persons who first use alcohol after the age of 21. Why do you think that's true? Just real quick. Why do you think people who report using after 21 don't tend to go on to have full-blown disorders, whereas people who use between the ages of, you know, 12 and 15 or 10 and 15, why would that be true?
Brain development.
Yes.
Interfering with their ability to do judgments.
So somehow it interferes with brain development?
For learning behaviors.
Yeah, I mean, I, if you really think about it, like, if you're coping with negative events by changing your mood with a substance, you're not learning to tolerate life, because life is a bunch of negative and positive events. You don't learn to tolerate life with these other strategies. And so when you think about the treatment of giving skills, the idea is that somehow there's some skill deficiencies in tolerating life's ups and downs. And therefore, the CBT as a skill-based treatment works for just this type of, like, psychological finding. That if you miss it in adolescence, it's not like you can't get it. You can get it. It's just that you learn to cope with the world a certain way. One of the early findings that Marlatt had about addictions is that generally, people are less emotionally expressive if they have alcohol disorders or substance disorders. And what that really comes down to when you think about it is they're probably not used to talking about their emotions and expressing them to people and having that feel good. Well, that's a skill. And as adolescents, if I talk to my friends when I break up with a girlfriend, if I can talk to my best buddies or whatever, rather than going out and getting high, I now have a skill, and it makes me feel okay if I can tolerate the distress of the breakup, rather than just hitting the substance. Does that make sense? So I've learned this skill of how to de-stress via social interaction. So we're starting to uncover what those skills are. So a lot of the treatment strategies for addictions have really just 12 components. And if you learn those 12 sort of skill components, one of them being motivational interviewing, but one of them also being assertive communication and learning how to communicate effectively with you and other humans. So it helps you tolerate interactions, right? That's one. The other big finding is that guilt and shame, those two feelings, tend to help cause addictions or keep them going. That's what is the number one factor in a relapse, was inter and intrapersonal. 5 minutes now? Okay, inter and intrapersonal conflict. So when you say, what causes a relapse? So if you know that as a treatment provider, if you know that that hurts people, you want to teach people some conflict resolution. You want to teach them to express those emotions, and when they feel conflict, and try to resolve it before it causes someone to want to pick up. Right? Enter and entrust in yourself. And in the... Okay. Oh, this is interesting. This is what I was saying. This reversed. The largest number of recent initiates in 2010, marijuana, exceeded by, you know, a couple hundred thousand in this study, pain relievers. When we were looking back in 06, pain relievers, I think, were actually on top of marijuana. So there's been some trends, and I think these trends will continue to split. You'll see marijuana sort of really coming into the forefront again because of some of our culture right now. And then you look at these other ones. This is important for your work. And you'll have these slides. When you look at most drug users, they really are smoking and doing some other drugs, but a large majority of the population is smoking weed. And it just skips some of these because I think you can see, again, this 18 to 20-year-old has the highest drug use. I do think because many of you are in healthcare settings, how many of you are in hospital settings or primary care settings? Lots of you, right? So it is important for you to have a real understanding of the use of prescription meds and the non-medical use of prescription meds. And, you know, there's a large percentage of our population uses these. And, in fact, you talk about the psychology of that. When people say, look, my doctor prescribed me that for a backache, and, I mean, it's not like it's his fault, but, I mean, it really does work. Why would he give it to me? And I know I'm taking way too many, and I'm taking them, you know, and it's costing me a lot of money, but they work. And he's the one who gave them to me. So they, in essence, don't even own their own reason for getting addicted. And they maybe should. They have pain. And they actually legitimize that because of the pain, they deserve the meds, right? And so there's a whole nother complicating psychology in treating people with opiate addiction, particularly when they are medically related. And there are slides. I'm not, again, I don't want to go into these because I want to go into one more before I have to end. But these slides sort of essentially tell you where many people got their opiates are where they're obtained now. So they're worth looking at just so you know in the population that you're working with. All right. Are all of you familiar with ASAM criteria when I say that? Addiction Society, right? Do you know about it? Right? American Society of Addiction Medicine. Okay, so we sequence treatment based on the level of care. And so these are assigned numbers. But basically, we try to do early interventions, then outpatient, then intensive outpatient, then residential and detox. And so there's a grid. And so if you look up ASAM and you want to know how people can actually assign folks to treatment based on sort of a science, a logic model, you can look up the grid and it will tell you. I'm going to talk about one slide before I end that I think is well worth knowing. These are the different dimensions of why people are put into these different levels. We tend to try to put people in the lowest level first to see how they do. And in fact, insurance won't let us bill for a higher level if some people haven't failed in the lower level. And that makes common sense. You want to treat people in the sort of the most, the least intensive level possible. But I would look up, if I were you, just look up ASAM now that you've heard about it in the different dimensions. This slide is basically saying that in a lot of medical environments, doctors still do not think you can treat alcoholism, but this was done in the late 90s, early 2000s, that the efficacy rate they assign to being able to treat alcoholism or illegal drugs is very low, whereas hypertension and diabetes they feel they have a good handle on. But when you really look at the outcomes from those, they're all pretty even. That our effectiveness rate in treating drug addictions is just as effective as treating hypertension or diabetes, and therefore it's all the same. We really have to get a handle on the behavioral, repetitive, chronic nature of these disorders. Okay, and I'm just going to go to one slide. These slides will be up. I want to go to this slide, and then I want to read you these two slides, right, Bruce? Three slides? All right, three slides. I was pretty alarmed by this, but it made sense when you think about it, that if you think of someone's addiction as like a career or a way of living, Mike Dennis has done some research to show that it might last 27 years. And that's a lot longer than people have been doing anything in their lives repetitively, right? Particularly if it's daily use of weed or daily use of injecting, right? 27 years.
And that in order for treatment to work, when they looked at this group of people, this cohort of people from Illinois, actually, on the streets, and it took an average of 3 to 4 episodes of care, usually residential or detox for a certain number of these folks, right? And multiple episodes of care over decades. It wasn't like they just got one Mosberg intervention. They got many if they needed it, right? And this really blew me away, that it takes a year of abstinence before less than half the people will relapse. One full year, right? And when you talk to the neuroscientists, they'll tell you that it really is helping to reset the nerves in the brain so that they're not reactive to dopamine in the same way. They have neurological models for the reward system. And even after 3 to 7 years of abstinence, about 14% of the people relapse. Right? So this is a long-term care model. Right? The triggers are always there. That's what you have to understand. So they're always in front of you, and they're always tempting. If you were an addict, you always know what it feels like to go back to that place that might have been comforting, even though it cost a lot of distress. And the triggers and the cues are always in your brain. This is a George Valiant study and presentation that I think is really important. And he said that, you know, when you ask people who are in long-term recovery from an addiction, this is what they tell you. And it goes back to why it takes so long and so much abstinence before you don't use. They basically said, the thing that's helping me the most right now is that I have a sponsor or someone out there that I have to talk to every day about my addiction. And that person's like a supervisor. And that without that person to help me monitor myself, I wouldn't be as successful. So when you think of your treatment strategies, is there anybody in that person's social fabric that can become a person like that and not cause conflict? And there's a strategy of how you utilize a person like that, right? There's a strategy. You don't want it to be emotional. You want it to be very supportive in recovery. The other thing is that I really need to do things which replace dopamine, right? I need to find some relationships that don't make me feel guilty, that still love me, that give me unconditional love. And I need to find a community to be involved with, right, of people, not religion, but a spiritual community. And that just means I need to think of something greater than myself before I use. Do I have any sort of thing in life that keeps me going, that sustains me, that feels comforting? Because I'm not just thinking about my own reward system, I'm thinking about others. If that makes sense, I'm thinking about the community of people in general and the spirit of that, of giving to others. Okay? Alright, so those are the two slides. I guess I really didn't have three. And just had two, probably good timing. What's that?
Go ahead.
Want me to say that one? So the benefits of treatment are that it saves money for society. Treatment rates are similar or better than other chronic medical disorders. Increases the quality of life. Brief interventions can help many people. Longer interventions may be necessary. But we do know that with continued care over time, with a relationship with one of you that lasts a long time, that if somebody's going to relapse, they can call you up and say, hey, I need your help. If you keep the door open, relationship with a doctor that's going to happen anyway, where they're not scared to talk about addiction, that's really important for people that have chronic disease. So that was just sort of a morning wake-up call on addiction.